Good evening. Please be seated. Near Santa Paula, California, a small town near Los Angeles, is a college called Thomas Aquinas College. Thomas Aquinas College is very much like St. John's College in a lot of ways, and also different from St. John's in some important ways. To go into the similarities and differences in any detail would take far too long and go far too far afield for my task. For my task here and now is to introduce our speaker, Michael Agros. But mention of a few basic similarities will make the point and allow me to fulfill my responsibility. At Thomas Aquinas College, discussion over a seminar table is the fundamental method, just as it is here. And the discussions are about assigned readings in great books, just as they are here. At Thomas Aquinas College, members of the teaching faculty are called tutors, just as they are here. At Thomas Aquinas College, all students take the same courses across the curriculum, just as they do here. And all tutors lead courses across the curriculum, just as they do here. Because of the all-required curriculum, students who decide after they have been at some other college that they would rather attend St. John's must start over at the beginning when they come here. Michael Agros, after a year at another college, decided he would rather attend Thomas Aquinas College. So he went there and, as was required, started over at the beginning of the curriculum. He graduated in 1992, and after further study and other life events, as has similarly happened with a few St. John's College graduates, he returned to Thomas Aquinas College as a tutor and has been one for several years now. Over the years, SJC tutors have given Friday evening lectures at TAC, and TAC tutors have given Friday evening lectures at SJC. Dr. Agros is the latest in that series. Although Dr. Agros' PhD from Boston College in 1995 is in philosophy, and although he has published books and papers in theology and philosophy, some of which were mentioned in the flyer announcing his lecture tonight, he also has a deep and abiding interest in mathematics, including Euclid. The title of his lecture is, What is a QEF? Reflections on the Nature of Geometrical Making.
Thank you, Mr. Wales. All right. Although this is my first visit to St. John's College, I'm in many ways indebted to this school for my education. Over the last three decades or so, I've learned more things than I can count from the many wonderful manuals, notes, essays, and books that some of your tutors have authored, translated, or edited. So thank you, St. John's, for the unofficial distance learning program through which you taught me. And thank you also for the opportunity to thank you in person. Now, one of the several passions I share with the tutors and students of St. John's is geometry, my topic for tonight. My particular question is about the nature of geometrical construction, which I'll approach by asking what Euclid is up to when he signs off one of his propositions in the Elements with the letters QEF. The question might appear to be a trivial one, but in reality it is not. I don't just mean that geometry is one of the quadrivium rather than one of the trivium. I mean that the nature of geometrical construction is no small and inconsequential matter. Before our investigation into it is done, we'll have begun to see that this question is a point of departure from which several winding paths go out, running their courses through the main parts of theoretical philosophy and its history, and touching on the nature of art, science, reality, and the human mind. What one thinks of geometrical construction will shape what one thinks of greater things, and conversely. In another way, however, the question is perfectly trivial. That is, we can approach it through questions appropriate to each of the trivium. After that, we can ask about geometrical construction from the point of view of a mathematician, whose arts lie among the quadrivium, and finally from the higher vantage point of philosophy. Let's first consult the grammarian with our question. To the grammarian, what is the meaning of QEF will simply mean, what do those letters stand for? They're, of course, the initials of the Latin expression, quod erat faciendum, or that which was to be done. Here we have quod, a relative pronoun, erat, a form of the verb to be in the imperfect indicative, and faciendum, a future passive participle, which conveys the idea of necessity or obligation. Now, Euclid did not compose the Elements in Latin any more than in English, so we might worry that this Latin expression is some kind of ornament added by editors. The grammarian encourages us to look at the Greek to determine whether this is the case, And when we follow this advice, we discover that the Latin expression is a rough rendition of a formula that Euclid himself used at the end of his constructions. Euclid's Greek phrase is not exactly analogous to the traditional Latin one. His words are hoper eidei poiesai, in which hoper is an accusative neuter relative pronoun meaning the very thing which. Eidei is necessarily third person singular active, since it's a finite form of the impersonal verb dei. It is necessary. And here it's in the imperfect, so it was necessary. And finally, poiesai is the aorist infinitive active form of the verb poieo, to make, do. Taken all together, the expression translates to the very thing which it was necessary to do. Where the Latin has a passive participle, the Greek has an active infinitive. And where the Latin conveys the idea of obligation by means of casting facere as a future passive participle, Euclid conveys it with the special verb eidei, which derives from the verb deo, to bind. When Euclid signs off his other propositions, QED, these letters stand for the Latin expression quod erat demonstrandum, or that which was to be demonstrated. Euclid's own words are hoper eidei deixai, or the very thing which it was necessary to prove. From this humble beginning, we can see that it's Euclid himself, not merely his Latin or English translators, who saw fit to sign off propositions with a certain phrase, or rather with one or the other of two phrases. One more point of vocabulary before moving on. The distinction that Euclid implies by his two different ways of ending a proposition can be expressed not only by his phrases, but also in simple names. In his commentary on the first book of the Elements, Proclus observes that the propositions, now I'm quoting here, the propositions that follow from the first principles that Euclid divides, he divides into problems and theorems, he being Euclid, the former including the construction of figures, the division of them into sections, subtractions from and additions to them, and the latter concerned with demonstrating inherent properties belonging to each figure. So according to Proclus and many others, a proposition ending QEF is called a problem, and its purpose is generally to construct, whereas the name for a proposition ending QED is a theorem, and its purpose is generally to demonstrate. This terminology fits well enough with Euclid's own vocabulary. When he proposes to construct something, for example, to construct an equilateral triangle, he signs off QEF. When he proposes instead that something is true, he closes by observing that his conclusion is precisely what was to be demonstrated. So we may say that his propositions fall into two types, constructions and demonstrations. Euclid also uses the word theorem from time to time, as for example in Book 12, Proposition 2, where he refers to the first proposition of Book 10 as a theorem. Perhaps this word theorem is not exactly synonymous with demonstration. The theorem is the truth you wish to see, and the demonstration is how you see it. Analogously, the problem is what you wish to do, and the construction is how you do it. Although Euclid does not, to my knowledge, use the word problem in the Elements, the language of problems and theorems fits well with his practice of distinguishing between propositions that propose to construct or do and those that propose merely that something is true. We will return to this distinction later and find that it's somewhat subtler than it at first appears. The grammarian now takes a seat, and the rhetorician rises to take the floor. What light can rhetoric shine on the nature of a QEF? The rhetorician can tell us the general nature of the expression, the very thing which it was necessary to do. It is, in essence, an epilogue. Even the longest of Euclid's propositions is short compared to many speeches, so we should expect that whatever we find by way of prologue and epilogue in his propositions will be rather minimal. Nonetheless, we do find something by way of prologue and epilogue in every proposition of the Elements. Consider these words of Aristotle on the nature of prologue and epilogue. A speech has two parts. You must state your case, and you must prove it. You cannot either state your case and omit to prove it, or prove it without having first stated it, since any proof must be a proof of something, and the only use of a preliminary statement is the proof that follows it. Of these two parts, the first part is called the statement of the case, the second part the argument, just as we distinguish between enunciation and demonstration. And this is still Aristotle now. What you should do in your introduction is to state your subject in order that the point to be judged may be quite plain. In the epilogue, you should summarize the arguments by which your case has been proved. The first step in this reviewing process is to observe that you have done what you undertook to do. For the conclusion, the disconnected style of language is appropriate and will mark the difference between the oration and the peroration. I have done, you have heard me, the facts are before you, I ask for your judgment. That's pretty much the end of Aristotle's rhetoric right there. The minimal duty of an introduction or prologue is to state the case, the thing to be proved. Otherwise, your hearers or readers will not know how to take what you are saying. They'll have no sense of any order or direction or progress, since you've not told them where your argument is supposed to be going. The minimal duty of an epilogue is to make it plain that the argument is finished, or as Aristotle put it, to observe that you have done what you undertook to do. Each of these simple services to hearers or readers makes it easier for them to follow your argument, to know where it's heading, when it's begun, and when it's done. So Euclid's enunciations perform the basic duty of a prologue and state the thing to be done, and his sign-offs perform the basic duty of an epilogue and state that the thing to be done has indeed been done. The rhetorician's look at Euclid's way of signing off his propositions brings out what they have in common. Each is akin to an epilogue. For light on the difference between the two, we must turn to other arts and sciences, beginning with logic. Not long before Euclid composed his Elements, Aristotle, the father of logic, distinguished four types of questions that a science can ask. These are as follows. Does this subject have that property? Why does this subject have that property? Does this subject exist? What is this subject? Some thinkers have turned to these questions as a way to distinguish between problems and theorems. And here again is Proclus, whether he's thinking of Aristotle or not. He says, the followers of Zenodotus used to distinguish theorem from problem in the sense that a theorem seeks to know what character is attributed to the matter it is investigating, whereas a problem asks under what conditions something exists. Hence, the followers of Posidonius likewise distinguished between a proposition that inquires whether or not something exists and one that seeks to know what or of what sort it is. A problem, in other words, is a geometrical proposition that asks and answers the question, does X exist, by setting out to construct X, whereas a theorem is a proposition that answers the question, does X have such and such a property? Okay, that was Proclus. Let's turn to Euclid himself now and ask whether this is the right way to understand the propositions that he closes with the letters QEF. Are these Euclidean propositions asking the question whether the thing to be made or done exists or is possible? The moment we begin trying to interpret the constructive propositions in the Elements in this manner, Euclid seems to fight back. Consider, for example, proposition 1 of book 3, in which Euclid obliges himself to find the center of a given circle. Is this proposition proving the existence of the center of a circle? That seems a strange thing to do, since any circle has a center by its definition. In the course of the argument, Euclid never proves that the given circle has a center, but just assumes that it does. What about proposition 3 of book 1? In which, given two unequal straight lines, Euclid sets out to cut off from the greater a straight line equal to the less. Is this proposition proving that there exists, within a greater straight line, a part equal to a lesser one? That's also a strange thing to do, since it seems to be self-evident that any greater straight line must have a part in itself equal to a lesser straight line. Is the existence of such a thing doubtful, and then the doubt dispelled by such a construction? Are we to suppose that Euclid's 10th proposition in Book 1, which proposes to bisect a given finite straight line, proves the existence of a midpoint in a finite straight line? Is this a doubtful matter that can be put to rest only by a construction? Are we wondering, before we begin, whether straight lines can have midpoints? In propositions 27 through 30 of Book 1, Euclid considers certain properties of parallel straight lines before constructing a parallel in proposition 31. If we suppose that Euclid's constructions prove the existence of the things they construct, then before he constructs a parallel, he does not know whether parallels even exist. Then what is he doing in the propositions about parallels before that construction? Is he investigating the properties of parallels without knowing whether there are such things as parallels? Again, consider proposition 16 of Book 4, in which Euclid sets out to inscribe in a given circle a regular 15-sided figure. And here you may wish to refer to figure 1 on the handout. To construct his polygon, Euclid inscribes the side of an equilateral triangle and the side of the regular pentagon inscribed in the circle, both from the same point, so that the side of the pentagon cuts off arc AB and that of the triangle cuts off arc AC. He then observes that of the equal segments of which there, and this is quoting Euclid now. Of the equal segments, of which there are 15 in the circle ABCD, there will be 5 in the arc ABC, which is 1/3 of the circle, and 3 in the arc AB, which is 1/5 of the circle. Therefore, in the remainder BC, there will be 2 of the equal segments, each of which is 1/15 of the whole circle. Euclid has not yet divided the circle into these 15 equal segments, and he's already reasoning about them, which is as good as assuming the existence of his figure. He could have avoided speaking in this way, but it's a good thing he didn't. In speaking as he did, he reveals that he does not think of his construction as though it were a way to convince us that such a figure exists. Instead, he seems to take that as obvious. What's interesting to him instead, and what seems to be the point of his construction, is to show us how such a figure arises out of simpler ones that can be constructed in the circle. Examples such as these make it clear that Euclid did not intend every proposition ending in QEF to convince us of the existence of the thing constructed. Conversely, not every proposition in which Euclid intends to convince us of the existence of something closes with QEF. Consider, for example, Euclid's treatment of incommensurables. The existence of incommensurable magnitudes is far from obvious to beginners. It needs proof. It shocked the Pythagoreans. If we're in doubt about the existence of incommensurables as we begin reading the 10th book of Euclid's Elements, when do we become convinced of their existence for the first time? Perhaps in Proposition 9, which proves that squares which have not to one another the ratio which a square number has to a square number will not have their sides commensurable in length. And yet this proposition ends QED, as indeed every proposition in Book 10 does, even those that set out to find irrational lines of certain types and thus convince us of their existence. Not every construction in Euclid proves the existence of what it constructs or produces a thing whose existence was doubtful beforehand. The bisection of a line is not designed to prove the existence of its midpoint. Conversely, not every proof establishing the existence of something ends in QEF. The propositions in Elements 10 that are meant to convince us of the existence of certain types of incommensurable magnitudes close with QED, not with QEF. So, does it exist does not seem to be the question that a Euclidean construction is specifically meant to answer. Very well. Then what type of question is a Euclidean construction meant to answer? Consider Proposition 17 of Book 3, wherein Euclid proposes, from a given point, to draw a straight line touching a given circle. What sort of question is implied in this proposition? What motivates it? It is not the question whether there can be a tangent from the given point to the given circle. That there can be such a tangent, in fact, two of them, is fairly obvious from very general considerations. The real question is, where is the tangent? Or equivalently, what other geometrical entities already in our power to produce will realize this possibility? What geometrical thing or things will specify or locate the point of tangency for us? What structure will include the sought tangent as a part of itself? Or consider Proposition 9 of Book 1, where Euclid sets out to bisect a given rectilineal angle. The question here is not whether there can be a straight line that bisects the angle. That's obvious. The real question is, what elementary assembly includes the angle bisector as a component? If, prior to the construction, we're confident that it lies in the power of the elements at our disposal to come together in such a way as to construct what we seek, then our question is not, does such an assemblage of them exist, but only, what is it? For example, what is the assembly of elementary things that includes the bisector of a given angle? If, on the other hand, we're in doubt about whether such an assembly even exists, the question that Euclid is answering for us is indeed a question about existence, but generally not about the existence of the thing to be constructed, but of the thing that will construct it. Presenting an elementary bisection is an effective way to answer the question, does an elementary construction of the bisector of a given angle exist? In either case, the question that a QEF is meant to answer is indeed one of Aristotle's scientific questions, only it's not asking, or not always asking, about the existence of the thing to be constructed. Rather, it's asking whether something elementary includes the thing to be constructed, or what this elementary something might be. These reflections on Euclid's modus operandi suggest that his propositions ending in QEF are meant to answer a question like this. What disposition of what elementary things will produce such and such a thing? What is the most elementary constellation of geometrical objects that will get our job done? That's the kind of question every QEF seems to have been born to answer. This way of understanding the purpose of a QEF brings out that it teaches us both about the thing to be constructed and about the things that construct it. What we learn about the thing to be constructed is what prior things it comes from. What we learn about the things that construct it is that they include it in themselves somehow. The solution of a problem is most instructive when one sees that it's the most elementary contrivance capable of producing the sought result. It's possible to trisect a given angle using a conchoid, but the conchoid is not the first curve, the simplest one, that is so capable. The conic sections are the first ones. And that's no easy matter to prove. It's far from obvious that circles in straight lines don't have it in them to trisect a given angle, but they don't. And until we see that, we're left to wonder what are the first geometrical objects to possess the power of trisection. A construction can show that something lies within the productive power of things somehow prior to it or more elementary. What a construction often cannot do, however, is show that its way of getting the job done is the most elementary way. In Euclid's Elements, this problem does not arise much, since his elements are so elementary that the circle is the only curve in town. And it's evident that we cannot construct an equilateral triangle with only Euclid's straight lines and no circles, since straight lines do not contain in themselves any principle of measure or any reason why one straight line would be equal to another. When it comes to more sophisticated constructions, such as the third of a given angle, a trisection by conics will show that this product lies within the power of the conics, but not that it goes beyond the power of the circle. To see that, we would require more advanced conceptual equipment, such as the idea of a subfield of the real numbers. Sometimes Euclid had no choice but to construct things as he did. Given his principles, he could not have produced the equilateral triangle more simply or elegantly than he did in his first proposition. Other times he had choices. When tasked with drawing a tangent from a given point to a given circle, for example, here again you might wish to refer to figure 2 on the handout, concentric with the given circle C, he draws a second circle whose radius is the straight line between the given point A and the center of the given circle E. That's one way to go. Another way would be to draw the circle on that straight line AE as diameter. This circle will cut the given circle at the two points of tangency. Rather pretty, really. So why not go that way? Well, one could do so, but then one would need to reorder Euclid's theorems and present 331 before 317 so that one can reason from the fact that the angle in a semicircle is right. That's also doable, but only at the expense of Euclid's way of ordering his propositions about circles in Book 3. The first 19 of those propositions are about the special relationships of circles to straight lines. Propositions 20 through 34 are about the relationships of circles to angles. Propositions 35 through 37 are about the relationships of circles to certain rectangles and squares. He relates circles first to straight lines, then to rectilineal angles, then to rectilineal figures. That order is eminently reasonable, even if another order is possible. So Euclid's constructions are not always or even usually the only ones that get the job done. In some cases, they might not even be the easiest or simplest way to get the job done as measured by the number of steps he takes. Nonetheless, there's almost always a good and instructive reason why Euclid does things as he does rather than some other way. Euclid first orders his material in a large-scale way, deciding what kinds of questions to address first, what kinds to address afterward, based on general principles of moving from the simple to the complex, the equal to the unequal, the straight to the curved, the finite to the infinite, the commensurable to the incommensurable, and so on. There's always a reason for the order he settles on, an instructive reason and one that makes the assimilation of the elements easier, more memorable, and its movement more beautiful. Whatever large-scale order of treatment he settles on will often determine which particular construction for a problem he will adopt. If he wants to deal with what angles and circles tell us about each other only after dealing with what straight lines and circles tell us about each other, then he will not construct a tangent to a given circle from a given point by means of a theorem about the angle in a semicircle, since it's possible to construct the tangent without that, just using the relationships between circles and straight lines established in the earlier theorems. If this way of understanding Euclidean constructions is correct, Then we will be advancing in our understanding of Euclid when we begin to see him not as a mere geometer talking to himself in an abstract world devoid of people, but as a flesh and blood teacher making pedagogical decisions, ever bearing the benefit of his students in mind. Any adequate understanding of Euclidean construction must distinguish a problem from a theorem. Since this is a properly geometrical distinction, drawn only or chiefly by geometry and those employing it, we will discover its nature only if we turn to the geometer, and I suspect we will see it best if we turn to Euclid himself. Why did Euclid see fit to use two distinct epilogues for his propositions? What is the difference between a QEF and a QED? The answer that most readily suggests itself is very simple. When Euclid signs off QEF, he's claiming to have done something or made something. When he signs off QED, he's instead claiming to have proved something. Well, there you have it. In one kind of proposition, Euclid makes something, in the other kind, he proves something. Well, as soon as we say this, if only we have a little experience of Euclid, we see that we have not said quite enough. Most propositions ending QED not only demonstrate something, but also construct something along the way. And all propositions ending QEF not only construct something along the way, but also demonstrate something afterward. The two kinds of proposition are in fact so similar that it is in some way possible to reword any problem in the language of a theorem. Take Euclid's very first proposition, whose enunciation reads, on a given finite straight line to construct an equilateral triangle. We can, if we like, leave the constructive language out of it altogether and restate the enunciation like this. If two circles share a common radius and straight lines lie between each of its endpoints and one of the points at which the circles intersect, then the triangle that these straight lines contain will be equilateral. In this manner, we could, if we liked, reword all Euclid's problems as theorems and have done with the distinction entirely, which some people have done, in fact. They recommended that practice. What is it that motivates Euclid to insist on the distinction? Why not reword every problem as a theorem? One reason to insist on the distinction is to highlight the difference between geometrical things and their properties. In some propositions, we derive a property from a thing, and that's the job of a theorem, generally. In others, we derive a thing from a thing, and that's the job of a problem. For example, in Proposition 1 of Book 1, from the circles sharing the given line as a common radius, Euclid derives a new figure, namely the equilateral triangle. From previous things, he derives this new thing, worthy of its own name, a new figure that's just as much a thing as a straight line or a circle, and is itself an owner of properties, a seat of relationships. Since Proposition 1 brings forth not a mere property, but a quantitative being that owns properties, Euclid honors this fact by casting the proof in the constructive language of a QEF, the language not of one thing bringing forth properties, but of one thing giving birth to another. In Proposition 4, on the other hand, from the two given triangles that have the side-angle-side relationship, Euclid does not derive any new things, no new points, lines, angles, or figures. Instead, he just deduces new relationships beyond those that are supposed in the subject of the demonstration. From certain things and their relationships, he brings forth no new things, but only newly revealed properties. That's why the proposition ends in the letters QED. Now, whenever a proposition does both, he ends with the letters that fit the promise of the enunciation, since that was the ultimate purpose of the proof. For example, in Proposition 47 of Book 1, he describes squares on the sides of a right triangle, and yet he does not sign off QEF. The purpose of the proof is not to describe these squares, but to demonstrate a certain relationship among them. A more shocking case is the perfect solids. These are the crowning constructions in the whole of the elements, and yet Euclid closes those propositions with the letters QED. Well, this is because each of those propositions serves a dual purpose, to bring forth the perfect solid in question from more elementary things, and also, afterward, to demonstrate a certain relationship between the side of the solid and the diameter of the sphere in which it is comprehended. A second reason that Euclid distinguishes his propositions into two types is more pedagogical. Euclid is a teacher, one who's attentive to the things we naturally wonder about. After seeing in Book 3, Proposition 16, that the straight line at right angles to the end of a circle's diameter is a tangent, we naturally wonder how to draw a tangent to a circle from a given point outside the circle, rather than from a given point that's on its circumference. Euclid, accordingly, follows Proposition 16 with Proposition 17, in which he constructs a tangent to a given circle from a given point outside it. What happens if we try to reword 17 as a mere theorem? Well, we get the following enunciation. If any two radii of a larger circle be cut by a smaller concentric circle and the ends of the longer radii be joined to the ends of the smaller radii, then these lines are tangent to the smaller circle. Or, using the letters in Euclid's figure, and in figure 2 of the handout again, if EA, EF be any two radii of a larger circle and ED, EB radii of a smaller one so that D lies on EA and B on EF, then A, B, F, D are tangent to the smaller circle at B and D. Well, that is perfectly true, and the content of this statement, considered absolutely and apart from the order of the ideas, is largely the same as the content of Euclid's proposition as he presents it. Only, nobody cares about that content put in the way that I've just rearranged it. The emphasis is all wrong. After proposition 16, which shows us how to draw a tangent to a circle from any point on it, we wonder how to draw a tangent to a circle from any point outside it. That's the question that we actually have, and Euclid respects that. If we take his construction and force it into the language of a theorem, cramming the given point and the sought tangent into the very subject we're talking about and deriving the tangency as a property of one of the lines that's in that whole construction, then we've remade the proposition so that it answers a question that nobody's asking. Probably, we will not even see that this odd theorem implicitly answers the question that we actually do have. We will have to reintroduce the idea that one of the points on the outer circle might be thought of as a given point outside the inner one. The would-be theorem, in other words, would give us the answer to a real question without ever mentioning that question or mentioning the fact that it answers it. We're left with a rather odd assortment of objects in which certain lines are proved tangent to one of the circles, like a boring exercise in a math textbook. We don't usually start with a random assembly of elementary geometrical things and then wonder what other object might be lurking in there, but start with an object we know is possible and wonder in what assembly it might be lurking. Sometimes then, Euclid could have cast a problem as a theorem, but he did not do so for such reasons as these. Conversely, we also find cases where Euclid could have cast a theorem in constructive form but chose not to. Proposition 42 of Book 10, for example, demonstrates that a binomial straight line is divided into its terms at one point only. This is a remarkable fact. If I set out a rational straight line and then add together two straight lines that are commensurable in square only, it's impossible to divide the resulting straight line, the binomial, into two other rational straight lines commensurable in square only. That's wonderful, given the infinite divisibility of the line. Euclid highlights this wonderful fact by stating it as a theorem. If we forcibly repackage this proposition as a construction, the enunciation will be, to divide a given binomial line into two rational straight lines commensurable in square only. If the construction brings out that there's only one way thus to divide it, that will be a side note, or something we will be left to notice on our own, when really it's the main thing worth noticing. Conversely, Euclid's proof that there's only one way to divide a binomial does not show us how to divide a given one, but presumes that this is done already. The change from theorem to problem is therefore not a matter of mere semantics. It shifts our attention from one kind of question to another one entirely. A third reason Euclid distinguishes constructions from theorems is that rewording every proposition as a theorem would often make his language needlessly burdensome and unmemorable. This is the economic or mnemonic reason behind the QEF. Here's what I mean. Often it is not a single entity that gives rise to a new thing, but a nameless complex of things that would be very tedious to describe. For example, we do not have a single name for a pair of circles sharing a common radius. At least I don't know one. Maybe somebody out there does. but that's the matrix which produces the equilateral triangle in elements 1-1. And I would not even like to try to describe the constellation of objects in elements 1-2 so as to restate its enunciation as a theorem about all those things. It would read like an enunciation in Apollonius, or worse. If we wish to avoid such needless, tiresome, unretainable descriptions of assemblies that we care about only insofar as they answer problem-style questions anyway, then we must be willing to say such things as, on this line, let an equilateral triangle be constructed. The interesting and nameable subjects of demonstrations don't occur in the wild fully equipped with circles and equilateral triangles right where we need them, so we must introduce them, and in doing so, we can hardly avoid the language of construction. And Euclid does not want to postulate all such introductions of new things, for example, to construct an equilateral triangle on a given finite straight line, when they can be derived from more elementary constructive moves, especially when it's illuminating to see how a more complex thing can come out of a number of simpler ones. We can further refine our understanding of Euclidean constructions by asking about their relationship to the other quadrivial art that is the business of Euclid's Elements, namely arithmetic. Only 54 of Euclid's 465 propositions end in QEF, and none of these occur in the number books. Why not? Why does a QEF seem to be something peculiar to geometry? This question bears not only on what we think a QEF is, but also on the question what a liberal art is. Why is geometry called an art and not just a science? Presumably because it not only studies geometrical things, but also makes them. Why then is arithmetic called an art and not just a science? And why does Euclid think arithmetic contains only demonstrations and not constructions? Is there nothing to be done about numbers? Well, there are jobs to be done in the number books. For example, given two numbers, Proposition 34 of Book 7 fulfills the obligation to find the least number which they measure. And given two numbers, Proposition 18 of Book 8 proposes to investigate whether it is possible to find a third proportional to them. These propositions nevertheless end QED, even though the very similar job in Proposition 11 of Book 6, to two given straight lines to find a third proportional, ends in QEF. I can think of three reasons, possibly not the only ones, but I can think of three for Euclid's refusal to grant QEF status to any propositions in the number books. The first is that the number books are about discrete quantities, not continuous ones. A continuous quantity is like a raw material in which lie an infinity of inherent but as yet unrealized possibilities, whereas a discrete quantity is not, or not so much. There are only so many units to be gotten out of the number 5, and the number 4 is not a mere possibility in the number 5, but is already there in it in some way. But the points inside a circle are not all there already, nor are the semicircles that a circle might be divided into. Those things come about when we introduce new divisions that were not really there before. In this way, the subject matter of geometry permits a real making in a way that the subject matter of arithmetic does not. Aristotle even calls the geometrical continuum houle nauete, or nauete, that is, conceivable material, I guess, or perhaps imaginable material, depending on how you want to take nous in there, or perhaps and that's in contrast to houle aisthete, the sensible material, such as bronze or wood. It's an interesting expression he has, and maybe Euclid thinks along the same lines. Another reason that the letters QEF do not occur in Euclid's number books is the difference between producing numbers and producing figures. Euclid's numbers are all produced in the same way, by the repetition of the unit. If you repeat the unit often enough to get the number 6, you just have to continue the same process a step further to get 7. On the other hand, the figures of geometry are not all produced by the same kind of process. We cannot produce a regular heptagon simply by taking the process for constructing a regular hexagon one step further. And again, the nature of the continuous seems to be the culprit here. In the smallest thing in arithmetic, or at least Euclid's arithmetic, the unit, there is no room for any differences at all. But there's no smallest part of the continuum, and in any tiny patch of it, as itty-bitty as you please, there lies an infinity of diverse possible positions or arrangements of things. And this complicates matters. Diverse geometrical objects have structurally distinct ways of coming to be, whereas Euclid's numbers all have the same kind of genesis. There's nothing to be gained from constructing the numbers, as there is in constructing figures, so Euclid does not bother constructing the numbers. It's as if he takes them to be already there, and the only job left is to find out their various relationships. A third reason for the absence of the QEF in arithmetic has to do with its classification as an art. If there are no constructions in arithmetic, why is it reckoned as an art? I suspect it's due mainly to its use of an art especially suited to its purposes, the art of calculation, the art Plato called, I guess he was referring to it, logismos or logistikos. Calculation is roughly analogous to construction,
We speak of operations that we perform on numbers and products of multiplication, for example, as though we were doing things to the numbers and making new ones. More modern mathematicians, such as Richard Dedekind, even speak of creating numbers. But even if that is a legitimate thought, it's not an elementary one. Our first encounter with calculation is in practical situations in which we need a way of ascertaining a number in terms of operations on others. In such situations, we're not really producing a number so much as coming to know it, one might say. If you want to know how many tiles there are in the kitchen floor, but you don't want to count them all, you might count the 16 that go this way, then the 25 that go the other way, and employ the art of calculation to get the product, 400. A very useful art indeed. Only, it does not produce the number, or at least need not. What it must do is enable us to see what number is related to these other numbers in a certain way. Logic is called an art, not because it makes the things that we wish to know by means of it, but because it makes the things by means of which we wish to know. The logician teaches us to make arguments, distinctions, definitions, and statements, which are tools of the mind. The logician shows how to make these instruments of thought by showing the order we can put into our words that will produce them. Calculation seems to be a little like that too, only it's especially concerned with numbers and the rules for manipulating symbols of them that will enable us to know the number that we seek. In any case, it does not produce numbers so much as make certain numbers known in terms of others, and to the extent that this is true, a calculation is not constructive enough to be thought of as a QEF. Geometry is also concerned with the art of measurement, or gives us principles whereby to measure one magnitude by another, and tells us when this is possible and when it isn't. Measurement, like calculation, is an art that does not so much make a quantity as make it known. Construction, on the other hand, produces a quantitative thing itself, and not only our knowledge of it. And so geometry has an additional reason for being classed as an art. If these are indeed the reasons behind Euclid's choice to refrain from using the QEF epilogue in the number books, then it's the nature of a QEF to deal with continuous quantity in particular because it has more the nature of material than mere units do, and we can realize things in it that existed only as possibilities prior to our work. I will now leave behind all the liberal arts and approach the question about the nature of geometrical construction from the somewhat higher altitude, one might say, of philosophy, a liberal discipline, but not an art, I think. Some explanation of what I mean is in order, so I hope you'll forgive a brief personal anecdote. My own interest in geometry began in high school, when some of my attempts at mechanical drawing led me to discover, quite by accident, that the side of a regular hexagon inscribed in a circle is exactly equal to the radius. I was amazed, flabbergasted, actually. How could these figures that I had drawn, that I had made, turn around and tell me things about themselves that I had never suspected and which seemed almost too good to be true? How could they behave in such intelligible ways, exist in such beautiful symbiotic relationships without my having made them to do so? I also wondered whether the relationship between the circle and the inscribed hexagon was really quite exact, or did it perhaps just come close enough to fall within the margin of error permitted by the width of my pencil lines? Somehow I felt the relationship was too beautiful to be something merely good enough for government work. It had to be exactly true somehow. But then I wondered, about what was it exactly true? My circles in straight lines were not exact, and neither were anybody else's. What exactly had I made? And had I made anything exactly? At the time, I had no idea how to approach these questions. Some years later, I read Euclid for the first time and found myself stumbling back into that world that I'd accidentally encountered in the form of a hexagon inscribed in a circle. His definitions made lines into exactly straight or exactly circular, breadthless lengths. His constructive postulates admitted these perfect beginnings into the world that he was inviting me to consider, and from there it was more or less a matter of pure logical consequence that the side of an inscribed hexagon should equal the radius. But what was this world, and where was the making of its figures taking place? This is an enormous question, and I do not hope to exhaust it or settle it definitively, but only to trace out a partial answer in order to provoke further thought on the question, not least my own. The first question is whether Euclid's constructions are about realities outside our minds or within them. If we think the constructions are somehow true, it's easiest to suppose that they're about things outside our minds. So let's begin with that supposition. Very well. The equilateral triangle Euclid constructs in his very first proposition is supposed to be something, an extramental reality that he's given us the ingredients for, or the recipe for. So where is it? Two possible answers come to mind. Either it's in some ideal realm of eternal geometrical forms, or else Euclid is saying that equilateral triangles can exist in the natural world and its materials. Both positions have their advocates. If we're particularly keen to preserve the exactness of Euclid's constructions and the timeless truth of them, we're more inclined to believe that they're about a world of eternal forms. Once we head off in this direction, however, we'll find it difficult to reconcile the idea of construction, which means that we produce things that did not exist before, with the idea that the things produced are eternal and unchangeable entities that exist independently of us. For this reason, some philosophers have suggested that the constructive language in geometry is actually absurd, that our constructions only cause us to come to know figures that already existed from all eternity and do not actually bring anything into being. In the Republic, Socrates reproaches those who use constructive verbs in geometry, saying that this science is in direct contradiction with the language employed in it by its adepts. When Glaucon asks how this is so, Socrates explains that their language is most ludicrous, though they cannot help it, for they speak as if they were doing something, and as if all their words were directed toward action. For all their talk is of squaring and applying and adding and the like, whereas in fact the real object of the entire study is pure knowledge. Knowledge of that which always is, and not of a something which at some time comes into being and passes away. Proclus, in his commentary on Euclid's Elements, constructs a similar contention, a similar contention of those who would have it that all the demonstrations of geometry are really theorems, and there is really no such thing as problems, because there's no coming to be among mathematical objects. Now, Euclid would probably agree with Socrates that no one ever constructs the eternal form of what it is to be an equilateral triangle. That always was and always will be, and there's nothing we can do about it except to get to know it a little better. But Euclid never set out to construct what it is to be an equilateral triangle, but only an equilateral triangle on a given finite straight line. He constructs, in other words, an individual and not a universal. That Euclid has dealings with individuals is clear from the fact that he deals with many different instances of the very same kind of thing. The two circles intersecting in his construction of an equilateral triangle, for example, are two distinct individual circles, not what it is to be a circle somehow intersecting itself. And even Socrates would probably admit that individual circles and triangles can come to be in some way. Individuals are so central to what Euclid is doing in his constructions that he will sometimes refuse to close a proposition with QEF for no other reason than that it was not about individuals. For example, in proposition 33 of book 10, he proposes to find two straight lines incommensurable in square, which make the sum of the squares on them rational, but the rectangle contained by them medial. The proposition is essentially a construction, and yet he concludes with QED. Why? Because there's not a unique individual pair of lines that will satisfy the requirements, but an infinity of different pairs of straight lines will answer to what is required. The proposition, as stated, is more about certain kinds of pairs of straight lines, not about an individual pair that is sought. Well, then why doesn't Euclid restate the problem so that it is about an individual pair sought? Because even if that can be done, that's a distraction from the interesting thing that Euclid wants us to see. It is surprising that such pairs of straight lines can exist at all, given all the restraints put on them. And there's no urgent need to find any individual pair of such lines, for example, to divide some given straight line into such a pair. Given the nature of the case and the interests of the human mind, the proposition is naturally a QED, and not a QEF. What if we protested that science must be about universals, not individuals? If I draw a red triangle on my living room wall, there could be no scientific knowledge of that, since science is knowledge of what has to be the way it is, whereas the red triangle on my wall can change and can cease to be altogether. So how can Euclid concern himself with individuals? Well, here is where Euclid's use of what is given comes into play. Nearly every Euclidean construction requires something that is given, such as a given point, a given angle, a given finite straight line. What is given is an individual instance, and yet it retains certain aspects of a universal. You get to pick the individual instance that will be subjected to this process. So Euclid cannot possibly know or reason from anything peculiar to its individuality, but only from what is common to it and any other individual that might be given to him by somebody else. So far as that goes, the given thing behaves like a universal. Nonetheless, it's an individual. It is a finite straight line, not just what's common to all finite straight lines. And so we can build something on it, such as an equilateral triangle. Euclid's device of beginning his constructions with given things thus allows him to perform an interesting balancing act between the individual and the universal. The given finite straight line, for example, is an individual, so it exists in the realm of the actionable. Nonetheless, precisely because nothing is specified about its individuality except that it is a finite straight line, the given is like a universalized individual. It's an instance, but one whose peculiarities are ignored and ignorable because they're irrelevant. In this way, we can see that what we did with our own line can be done with any. By this use of what is given, Euclid seems to be hinting that we do not need to posit a world of separately existing eternal forms in order to understand what he is doing in his geometry. His universal truths are about common features that never exist anywhere except in individual instances of things. When he says that every triangle has an angle sum of two rights, he means that this is true of every individual triangle because it is a triangle, not that this is true of some universal triangle existing apart from them all. Now, if Euclid is concerned with individual instances of things, is he therefore proving the possibility of constructing physical individuals? Three things get in the way of thinking so. First, Euclid never mentions physical materials, whether in particular or in general, at least in the elements now, and I'm not thinking of the optics. Second, the moment we take him to be talking about the physical world, the truth and exactness of his statements will be in jeopardy. Are there perfectly straight lines in the world and perfectly circular circles? Are there lines at all? Unless there are perfectly sharp edges of bodies or perfectly sharp boundaries between one quality and another, maybe there are no lines in the sensible world. At the very least, some materials appear to be more capable of holding an edge than others. Is it possible to get a perfectly sharp edge in styrofoam? If not, Euclid was obliged to tell us which materials were preferable for his experiments. As it is, he said nothing. Third, his three constructive postulates are listed together right before his fourth and fifth postulates, which he apparently takes to be self-evident truths. And yet, even if it is true that there can be perfectly straight lines and flat surfaces in the world around us, this is clearly not self-evident, but a matter of investigation or else stipulation. Indeed, it's not an easy thing to say how one would investigate such a claim. Suppose somebody said that the path of a ray of light in empty space far from massive bodies is a perfectly Euclidean straight line. How shall we test this statement? By what better standard, physical standard of straightness, shall we determine whether the light ray is straight? If Euclid is suggesting that his three constructive postulates are self-evident truths by laying them down without defense and right before the self-evident statement that all right angles are equal, then he must not be thinking of the physical possibility of straight lines and circles. Although Euclid might be thinking of that sort of thing in his optics, his mind seems to be far from it in his elements. But if he does not see himself as discussing eternal forms existing apart from individuals outside our minds, nor as constructing things in physical materials outside our minds, what's left? He must be teaching us to construct things within our minds. At least once in the elements, Euclid directly implies that he thinks of his constructions as things going on in the mind. In proposition 18 of book 12, he begins by saying, "Let the spheres A, B, C, D, E, F have been conceived." Neno estosan. The spheres do not have to exist outside the mind for him to talk about them. It's enough that they've been conceived. That's enough. This fits with Aristotle's expression again, that conceivable material, that kind of idea. The things of geometry are made out of an imagined material, which is just a uniform three-dimensional continuum considered apart from, or in abstraction from, any particular kind of three-dimensional thing in the world. Does this understanding of Euclid preserve the exactness of his objects? What exists in the human imagination presumably exists in the human brain, which is incapable of infinite resolution. When I imagine straight lines and circles, the images I form are rather worse, not better, than the ones in the Green Lion edition of the Elements. Though I still puzzle over this question myself, I think the truth must lie somewhere along the following lines. Geometry is not about our images, but about the things we're imagining. And though our images are not perfect and exact, the things we are imagining are. We don't need a perfect and exact image in order to become aware of a perfect and exact thing. When I see a clearly written sign, the visual impression I form of it is often blurry due to the weakness of my eyes. Nonetheless, my inexact image of it might be adequate for me to read exactly what it says, since my eyes are not the only cause of my understanding what I see. Something similar, perhaps, is going on when I imagine the things that Euclid has me construct. My image or diagram of an equilateral triangle is a bit crooked. The sides are not exactly straight, and they have some width. The image is nonetheless adequate to reveal to me that a perfect version of this is possible just in the nature of continuous quantity, even if it's not possible in the physical world where continuous quantity, in fact, exists. Put another way, if equilateral triangles are not possible in the physical world, that must be for some reason other than the very nature of the continuous, just as the impossibility of dividing an iron bar in half forever is not because continuous quantity is only finitely divisible, but because of something about the nature of iron. If something like this is right, then geometry is a mixed sort of science. On the one hand, it's about things that we construct in our minds, a bit as logic is about arguments and grammar about sentences. On the other hand, geometry is also about the continuum, whose essence we do not construct, but merely consider, although we consider it apart from the natural conditions and limitations with which it exists in the sensible world. Here arises another central question about geometrical construction. In any given construction, how much do we construct? Immanuel Kant said we produce pretty much everything in our constructions, even the material out of which we make them. According to him, the continuum itself is a construct of our mind. Though we produce it automatically and not by art, continuous quantity or extension is not a property of things themselves, but our mind invests them with it. This surprising and radically modern take on the nature of quantity and construction is reminiscent of the disagreement between Aristotle and those Platonists who wanted universals to be things outside the mind. Aristotle denied this, insisting instead that universality is just a property attached to things when our mind considers their common features while ignoring their individual peculiarities. In a similar way, Kant makes quantity not a property of things outside the mind, but only of things within. This obliged Kant to say that even quantity, even in nature, not just in mathematics, is also the product of our minds and is not a real property belonging to physical things as they are in themselves. Now, while this Kantian understanding of quantity as a purely mental phenomenon neatly explains why nature obeys intelligible quantitative laws, it conflicts with our sense that bodies exist independently of us, and conflicts also with more recent discoveries that nature behaves in ways that do not agree with our way of imagining things, or not very well. More recent thought therefore parted ways with Kant, but only to take an even more radically modern turn. Since the advent of non-Euclidean geometries, many mathematicians and philosophers have taken the view that there is no sense to saying that any particular geometry is true, just in itself, and apart from a comparison with nature. A given geometry is self-consistent or not, interesting or not, useful or not, but there's no more sense to saying that its axioms are true than that the rules of chess are true. On this understanding, we're again more constructive than Euclid would have given us credit for, I think. The reason that the side of the hexagon is equal to the radius of the circle through its vertices, for example, is not because this is a truth about the nature of continuous quantity or space, but because we artfully select a set of axioms by which to logically construct a space in which that statement would be true. Whatever truth or error lies in these ideas, Euclid himself never speaks as though we construct the continuum itself, but always presumes this as a given material which we somehow find and understand but do not make, and in which we construct things. For him, the postulates and common notions from which geometry begins are not a matter of choice for us, but are just the primary realizations we have about what is possible in continuous quantity, a nature we find but do not make, and then contemplate apart from any specific natural material in which it might exist. These last considerations of Euclidean construction are the most tentative of those I've tried to make. Probably they raise many more questions than they answer. But taking all my reflections together, they do suggest an answer to the question in my title, which answer might be summarized as follows. A Euclidean construction, or QEF, is a demonstration of what combination of elementary things includes in itself a prescribed individual thing that's possible in the continuum. And not the continuum as we find it in nature so much, but as considered in itself apart from the physical materials in which it exists. If nothing else, I hope I've at least shown how deep is the seemingly simple question, what is a QEF? Thank you so much.